Why did some South Pole explorers survive while others died? It depends in part on how willing they were to eat dogs. I'm Peter McGuire, and this is my unlikely explanation. A little before the turn of the last century, advancements in technology and techniques allowed humanity to explore the most isolated places on the surface of the Earth, the North and South Poles. When looking into this topic, I found that surprisingly few explorers died on polar expeditions. The amount of planning and expertise that went into these operations made them surprisingly effective at preserving life, even if the expedition in general fell apart. The same cannot be said for sled dogs. They died in astounding numbers. In this episode, I want to look into how to survive extreme expeditions, and in specific, why Amundsen and Shackleton survived Antarctica while Scott did not. Decisions related to how important animal lives were in comparison to human lives played a major role. But to understand these expeditions, we should first ask, what drives people to visit these extreme, inhospitable environments? There are several human societies that exist on the verge of extreme environments. I'm talking about extreme elevation, latitude, or climate, places like deserts. A distinction should be understood between living in a place and being able to survive a place. There are environments on Earth that even the hardiest people can only survive for multiple days or even hours without significant equipment. No one lives above 17,000 feet. No one lives south of 55 degrees or north of 80 degrees. You also don't see people who live in the Arctic mounting expeditions to the North Pole, nor do you see Nepalis trying to summit Himalayan mountains historically. The interest in exploring completely inhospitable places comes from complex settled societies. It's likely that no one had ever been to the top of Everest before Hillary, because there was no reason to do so. There's nothing to eat up there, there's nowhere to sleep, and the exposure will kill you in minutes. Where humans do live in extreme places, they're following food. The kind of vegetation that tends to grow in these places is indigestible to humans. But people can survive in an ecosystem with other animals by living off of their meat and using their bodies for tools and clothing. People who live near extreme environments tend to travel these wide circuits over the course of a year, and the circuits bring them to places with edible vegetation or seafood or plentiful water so that the group can replenish before it returns to the more extreme part of its journey. They develop their unique survival methods for these extreme parts of their routes so that they can catch and eat their prey, and they often learn from how those prey animals survive. Many explorers rely on the support of people who are more familiar with the areas that they're traveling to than they are. This lends a huge advantage to explorers who are journeying to distant but populated lands. So consider exploring firsts like Columbus crossing the Atlantic, Magellan circumnavigating the world, or Lewis and Clark surveying the continental U.S. These explorers didn't have to invent new ways to survive in these areas. They could rely on the techniques and the material support of the people they met along the way. After the populated world was mapped, explorers turned to unpopulated lands, but they still relied on human help. Cook and Peary relied on Arctic peoples when they were trying to reach the North Pole. Edmund Hillary relied on Himalayans in general, and the Nepali Indian Sherpa Tenzing Norgay in particular, when he climbed Everest in 1953. The impulse to explore these most isolated places on Earth has little to do with the usual reasons why humans move around, like food or overcrowding or strife. Instead, it tends to grow out of the concerns of complex society. There are commercial and political reasons to explore. Most early expeditions were to establish trade routes or to map territory. And then, later on, there's more scientific reasons to explore. Through exploration, we have revealed the actual shape of the Earth, how materials and organisms react to extreme conditions, and with the polar expeditions in particular, we gained important data on how gravity works by taking readings at the poles. But the impulse to explore also has this very basic human objective, which is prestige. It's a kind of a game. A game is a system where certain rules are put in place to create arbitrary competition. Exploration puts this on a global scale. The prestige of exploration comes from winning the game. Now that we can determine what the tallest mountain in the world is, we ask who's going to be the first to reach it. Now that we can determine latitude, we're going to say, well, who can get to those poles first? It's our ideas about what accomplishment means that lends prestige to feats of exploration. World firsts are firsts because we have to first invent a reason to attempt them. Exploration takes a very basic human behavior, that of bringing along rations on a hunt, in case the gathering isn't good, and it elaborates. To survive the unsurvivable, you must package up a miniature version of your own habitat that you can bring with you. We see this at its most extreme with manned spaceflight. Every ounce of weight represents an enormous additional cost of fuel, so scientists create the smallest, most efficient habitat that a human can survive in safely. To mount an expedition, you must bring along material necessities, things like food and water and shelter, and in the extreme case of space, you also have to bring air. But you also need your culture, in the form of the tools and knowledge that you possess. To navigate on an ocean, away from land, you need to have the right instruments and the right math. To navigate through space, you need a lot of instruments and math. To journey through inhospitable lands, you need both your material necessities, but also your intellectual ones. For me, the most interesting part of exploration is the stories. Explorers face overwhelming odds in conditions that most people never contemplate experiencing. That fascination with the edge of survival, with the scrappiness that's required to overcome threat after threat to your life, is what's so fascinating about these stories. The men who ventured to the poles were attempting a similar sort of thing to journeying into space, which is a totally backwards way of putting it. But when I was growing up, the great explorers' stories that I heard about were the stories of spacemen. So that's my point of entry. When you look at exploration, there's sort of a ladder of inhospitableness. On the bottom rung, there would be journeys to foreign lands that have already been settled. And on the top rung, so far, we're talking about journeys into outer space or the deep sea. So, for example, if you were a sailor exploring the New World or Asia in the 17th century, you would have been somewhere in the middle of this scale. You would face great danger from storms, you could run out of food, and you could become marooned without rainwater to drink. These are no small dangers. But in a ship, you can get propulsion from wind or from oars, you can fish for food, and every now and then it will rain. These are possibilities for survival. Whereas if you go to the furthest extreme, you have space travel, where there's no food, no water, no air, and if you run out of fuel, you drift forever on that trajectory, through a foodless, airless, waterless space. So polar expedition tends to be more similar to the latter case, simply because the poles are so inhospitable to life. The exploration feats of the early to mid-20th century represent an important stepping stone into that space of the inhospitable. So, what are the considerations when striking out into this space? First, let's think about how do we approach the South Pole. Antarctica is a huge island. It's about twice the size of Australia, and it's completely barren. We now know that life died out in Antarctica around 15 million years ago. Cooling and ice started accumulating in earnest when the landmass separated from South America, sometime between 20 and 40 million years ago, and circular winds and currents formed, which keep Antarctica's cold isolated from any warm air or water that might try to enter it. At the turn of the century, there were no permanent stations on the continent, although Antarctic islands further north had semi-permanent whaling stations. Semi-permanent stations weren't erected on Antarctica itself until 1929 and onwards, starting with the airman Richard Byrd's Little America, which I discuss in the North Pole episode of this podcast. Keep in mind that this far south, when I say south, I mean inwards, towards the continent, towards the pole, and north means outwards, towards the rest of the world. The continent is composed of two lobes of land, with ice shelves filling in the watery space between them. Ice constantly runs down off of the mountains of the landmass, which replenishes these enormous ice shelves as their edges break off into that circumpolar current. The ice shelves are fairly stable and allow closer access to the pole because they are where the continent is skinniest, so to speak. Because they are ice and constantly drifting outwards, there's no use in mapping the features of the ice shelf. So every expedition needed to scout and locate an appropriate landing site to make base camp. Most picked a spot on the Ross Ice Shelf, on the New Zealand side of the continent. Most, but not all, Shackleton in 1914 tried to sail even closer to the pole on the then unexplored side that faces South America. In either case, if you want to reach the pole, you need to make a naval landing. So the first thing you might consider is your vessel. This isn't as important when you're traveling to survivable lands, but again, space travel kind of helps us understand the importance of this. Apollo 13 experienced a malfunction that made the command module unsafe, and they only survived by using the lunar module's self-contained life support system, which duplicated much of the command module's life support. So there's no question that the crew would have died if there hadn't been that other module for them to go into. Redundancy of systems was a major part of NASA design philosophy, and that saved lives. Redundancy would no doubt have prevented the great hardship that Shackleton's failed 1914 expedition faced. When Shackleton attempted to cross the Antarctic continent in 1914, he did actually bring two ships, but the second one stopped on the opposite side of the continent, and it was meant to supply the second half of his journey. The two ships could not contact each other or the outside world. It was not yet possible to send a radio signal far enough. Imagine an Apollo 13 without the room of trained, focused scientists on hand to troubleshoot the problems. So when Shackleton's ship, the Endurance, became stuck in the ice and eventually sank, Shackleton had to rely solely on his supplies, his crew, and his wits. They had to camp on a plate of ice for several months as it drifted away from the Antarctic, watching their mortally wounded ship slowly sink beneath the ice for 3 weeks. After months, they drifted near enough to an Antarctic island to make the hop by lifeboat, and then survived for 3 months on this frozen, barren island while Shackleton and three others searched for help in the surviving lifeboat. The problem was with the construction of the vessel itself. The Endurance is reckoned to be one of the strongest wooden ships ever built, if not the strongest, but it was still crushed by the Antarctic ice. The vessel that Roald Amundsen, a Norwegian polar explorer, used, the Fram, was objectively less strong, but it survived the ice much better. This is because the Fram had a wide and shallow shape that caused it to be pushed upwards by the colliding ice instead of being pinched between the plates of ice. The Fram was specifically designed to be frozen in ice as a strategy to reach the North Pole. She proved herself on her maiden voyage, spending 3 years trapped in the ice and allowing the rotation of the northern polar ice to bring her within 5 degrees of the North Pole. The Fram had been built to reach the North Pole, and in fact, Amundsen had every intention of taking her there. Instead, he became the first man to reach the South Pole, an irony that he commented on when he reached it. This also requires some explaining, and it gives us some insight into the motivations that drove the three contenders that we have. When Amundsen pitched his 1910 expedition to financial backers, it was with the goal of charting the Arctic Sea and performing scientific experiments at the North Pole. Robert F. Scott was at the same time preparing an expedition that was expected to be the first to reach the South Pole. Scott even sent Amundsen duplicates of his scientific instruments so readings from the North and South Poles at the same time could be compared. But then, the Cook and Peary that I discussed in the first episode of this podcast announced that they had reached the North Pole, and Amundsen quietly changed his plans. He wasn't sure if his financial backers, mostly governmental and scientific, would support the change. After all, not only had Peary not taken scientific readings of the North Pole, his astronomical observations weren't even released to the public. Amundsen did not announce his intentions to go to Antarctica to backers or to his crew until the last possible moment, as they left their last port of call in Europe. In doing so, he took on personally a great financial and professional risk. He wrote in his announcement that he hoped his achievements would atone for the offense. This gamble shows us that Amundsen was not nearly as interested in his geographic or scientific goals as his backers. He wanted to be the first to a pole. Ironically, he may still have been the first person to reach the North Pole. The motivations of his British counterparts are more complex, I would say. There were two British explorers seeking to claim the South Pole as their conquest around the same time, Ernest Shackleton and Robert Falcon Scott. And by the way, how great of a name is Falcon? The men met on a 1901 expedition to Antarctica aboard the Discovery. Scott, a naval officer, led the expedition, and Shackleton secured a position as the third officer because of his excellence in the Merchant Navy, which was considered a semi-official branch of the British Navy. Scott, Shackleton, and Edward Wilson made an attempt on the South Pole amongst their attempts to map Antarctica. They knew that this trip would mostly be to develop techniques and routes for later expeditions. They made it to 82 degrees south, which is no small feat. However, on the return trip, Shackleton became disabled by a combination of physical and mental breakdown, and when they returned to the ship, Scott ordered Shackleton to return home immediately. This was interpreted as the result of Shackleton's insubordination, low morale, or physical breakdown. This slight started a feud between the two men, and between Shackleton and the naval administration. Scott wrote in his account that he and Wilson had carried Shackleton in a sledge, which Shackleton found deeply insulting. A cold war developed between the two men, where they spoke highly of each other in the press while waging a public relations war. In 1907, Shackleton was the first of the two to return to Antarctica. His Nimrod expedition set a new record for the furthest south at 82 degrees 23 minutes, so about 97 miles from the pole. He also climbed Mount Erebus and identified the location of the South Magnetic Pole. This expedition was considered a huge success, and Shackleton gained great acclaim and celebrity. The only shadow that hung over it was cast by Scott. Scott had insisted that Shackleton not use the same anchorage that he had used for the Discovery expedition, calling it his own field of work. Shackleton attempted to honor this request, but was unable to find another suitable landing area. It seems that Scott and the naval establishment held a grudge about this landing site, and made showing up Shackleton a greater priority. And I have to say, as a modern observer, this seems ridiculous. In 1910, Scott set out to Antarctica on the Terra Nova. His statements to the press made it clear that his first priority was reaching the pole. He brought along scientists to collect weather data and perform experiments, but Scott stated that the geographical work of reaching the pole and mapping Antarctica was his first priority. Despite this, he remained so committed to the scientific goals that his insistence on collecting and lugging fossils as his supplies dwindled is a contributing factor in his death, which frankly makes him a hero. His fossils were eventually used as proof of the tectonic plate theory. Scott's expedition reached the South Pole on January 17, 1912. Instead of the pristine snow that he expected, he found black flags and a tent. They'd been left there by Amundsen. Inside the tent was a letter from Amundsen to his king, the King of Norway, with a note asking Scott to deliver it. That is quite the power move, and pretty dang rude. But it does give us clear evidence that Amundsen was the first to the South Pole. When Scott's body was found the following year, he had this letter with him. His journal does not dispute that Abinson had reached the pole first, despite the great personal pain it caused him. The motivation behind Shackleton's transatlantic expedition of 1914, that's a little harder to justify. He planned to land on the coast of the Weddell Sea and march to the South Pole and then rendezvous with the rest of his crew on the Ross ice sheet. He too brought scientists, but it seems pretty clear that his goal was to one-up Scott by reaching the South Pole and surviving. But since simply reaching the South Pole had already been done, he needed to justify new geographic goals for the expedition, hence the landing on the less explored side of the continent. He was not able to undertake this journey because this is the expedition where his ship got crushed in the ice and it sank. Shackleton never made it to the pole, and for much of the 20th century was forgotten. In the 1980s, scholarship turned on the memory of Scott, finding fault with many of his decisions and his fatal South Pole expedition, and Shackleton's memory was revived as the more committed and personable adventurer. Since then, views have more or less leveled out about the two. So, motivations ranged from barefaced ambition to slightly disguised ambition as part of a pissing match that continued on after one of the participants' death. I think it's time now that we get to the details of exploring Antarctica. So let's think for a moment what getting to the South Pole entails. Scott's route was about 862 miles, which is 1,387 kilometers, from the edge of the Ross Ice Shelf to the South Pole. The explorer, James Clark Ross, called the ice simply the barrier. This snow and ice that slides off of the continent rises in some places to 4 stories above sea level. Simply finding a place to land on it is difficult. Abinson described the ice shelf this way in 1911. Along its outer edge, the barrier shows an even flat surface. But here, inside the bay, the conditions were completely different. Even from the deck of the Fram, we were able to observe the great disturbances of the surface in every direction. Huge ridges with hollows between them extended on all sides. The greatest elevation lay to the south in the form of a lofty arched ridge, which we took to be about 500 feet high on the horizon. But it might be assumed that this ridge continued to rise beyond our range of vision. Once you cross the ice shelf, you come to the Beardmore Glacier, which is a 125 or 200 kilometer glacial valley that cuts through the Transantarctic Mountains. From there, you must travel another 400 miles, 650 kilometers, across the relatively flat and featureless Antarctic Plateau to reach the pole. The plateau consists of hard, windswept snow and contains some of the coldest and windiest places on Earth. There are constant blizzards during the 5 months of darkness called winter, so expeditions can only happen during the summer, when the sun doesn't set and the South Pole reaches a balmy negative 15 degrees Fahrenheit. In Celsius, that's also cold. Walking through deep snow and living on prepackaged rations is hard on the body. Manhauling a sledge requires around 6,000 to 7,000 calories a day. Scott's rations provided at most 4,500 calories a day, mostly of protein and fat, like seal meat that they would stew. Hikers and climbers today know that carbohydrates and sugars are much more effective for fueling the body for this kind of work than protein. So even at the best of times, the members of Scott's polar party were depleting their bodies by around 1,500 calories a day. As the situation grew dire, they went to half and then quarter rations, while still attempting to travel upwards of 10 miles a day through deep snow. Despite the 1,000 pints of lime juice Scott brought to the Antarctica, scurvy ravaged all of his and Shackleton's expeditions. Scurvy causes anemia, exhaustion, spontaneous bleeding, pain of the joints, ulcers, and it makes it difficult to heal from wounds. These are not the symptoms that you want to be fighting when you're spending all day, every day hiking. If you want to know the details of why dogs are so important for traversing this kind of terrain, please take a listen to the first episode of this podcast, which discusses expeditions to the North Pole. These expeditions are mounted in a sort of pyramid structure. Men walking through deep snow and ice can only carry so much on their backs and in a sled, far less than is required to survive the 5 months that an expedition like this takes. So, you send out teams to set up supply depots along the way. Dogs are very effective at hauling over ice, much more so than men, and they also can haul humans in sleds, which is much faster than humans can walk. That said, dog teams require tremendous skill to operate and experience to manage correctly, and they must be fed, which further increases the supply that's required. Scott had used dogs for parts of his Discovery Expedition No. 1, but came away unimpressed. He brought 25 dogs and they all succumbed, mostly due to handler error. The problem you see over and over again with dogs is feeding them. Food for the dogs adds weight to the sledge, and preparations usually underestimated how much dog food would ultimately be needed. For the Nimrod Expedition of 07, Shackleton hedged his bets and used a combination of motorized sleds, dogs, and ponies. He used the dogs mostly for depot laying and didn't use dog teams on the South Pole attempt itself. Most of the ponies he brought along died. For his 1912 South Pole attainment, Scott tried a similar combination. As with Shackleton, he found that the motorized sledging was ineffective in deep snow. Scott was apparently astonished at the strength of the ponies, but there are some key biological differences between dogs and ponies. Unlike dogs, ponies sweat, which makes them difficult to keep warm between marches in the constant cold. Dogs pant instead of sweating, and have fur that keeps their skin protected from the cold of the snow. Snow stays on the outside of their coat, insulated from their body heat, so the skin is less likely to get wet, and therefore cold. Ponies are heavier than dogs, and they have small hooves, which concentrate the stress of each step on the ice to a small area. As a result, they are far more likely to break through the ice and snow and become bogged down, or at least expend more effort than the dogs would over the same terrain. The issues with the sledges and ponies slowed Scott's party down and forced them to lay resupply depots further north, further from the pole than had been planned. Scott's inability to reach his depots on his return trip was a major factor in his death. After the slower-than-expected start, the expedition shot and butchered most of the ponies, which had been their plan from the outset. Scott used dogs mostly for depot laying, but they contributed to his death in their own way. During the pole attempt, Scott gave orders to the dog teams to restock the supply depots and then meet his party at 82 degrees. Various injuries and the ever-present effect of scurvy prevented the dog teams from restocking the depots further south. As a result, Scott had less fuel than expected to keep warm on his trek back from the pole. The dog team that had been sent to pick him up reached the major supply depot, which, as I said, was laid north of where it should have been, and found that it hadn't been stocked with dog food. The driver knew that he couldn't continue south to find Scott without starving the dogs to death, so, rather than attempting to find Scott, he waited at the depot until the food ran out, and then he returned to the coast. Scott was just 70 miles south of that depot when the dog team left, and he ultimately died just 11 miles south. Had the dogs been sacrificed, Scott would probably have survived. Abinson and his team had no such compunctions about dogs. He never considered any other method for crossing the ice. He was from Norway, which had a strong tradition of dog sledding, and had developed his methods in the Arctic, where ponies and heavy machinery on thin ice was unthinkable. He couldn't understand the British aversion to using dogs, and suggested that it might have been a matter of incompetence, which, from my looking into it, I yeah, that seems to be the case. Abinson brought 4 sledges with 52 dogs. 45 of them made it up the glacier, the Beardmore Glacier, and here they set up a camp that they called the Butcher Shop, and they butchered 27 of the dogs there. The dog meat became rations for the other dogs and for the men, and likely prevented the scurvy that plagued other South Pole expeditions. The cause of scurvy had not yet been identified, but eating fresh meat was known to prevent it. This is because most mammals produce their own vitamin C. In fact, primates are some of the only mammals that don't. Ultimately, 11 of Abinson's dogs survived the trip to the South Pole and back. They were donated to the Australasian Antarctic Expedition that started later that year, after a pack of the dogs fell into a crevasse, along with most of the expedition's provisions. The 6 remaining dogs from the original 52 that set out with Abinson were eaten. Ironically, eating these dogs caused the men to overdose on a different vitamin, vitamin A, which is found in dogs' livers, and it contributed to the death of one of the members. Seems like a terribly ignominious end for dogs that had done so much. In Britain, Abinson was widely criticized for eating his dogs, but the rest of the international community didn't make much of it. The way the whole expedition was conducted certainly speaks to an element of Abinson's personality, his ruthless efficiency. And that's the next factor I want to examine. Character, or you might call it leadership. Character is one of those things that's hard to quantify, but has a real effect on the success or failure of an expedition like this. All 3 explorers that I've talked about faced opposition from their crew members. How each reacted to this gives us some window into their character. So you'll recall that Abinson borrowed his ship, the Fram, from earlier North Pole expeditions. As part of this gentleman's agreement, when he borrowed the ship, he agreed to hire Hjalmar Johansson. Johansson had been on the original expedition of the Fram that had come so close to achieving the first North Pole attainment, but they hadn't quite made it. He was an expert dog sledder and skier, but his friends had become concerned about his drinking and restlessness, and the absence of employment. Abinson's expedition seemed like the perfect occupation to keep him out of trouble. When they arrived in Antarctica, Abinson was so anxious to get a head start on Scott that he initially set out much too early, in September, when it's still more or less winter. Keep in mind that in the Antarctic, winter happens from February to October, and during winter there is virtually no sunlight. This false start caused some bungling, dogs froze to death, supplies were lost, and as a blizzard approached, Abinson broke off a smaller party from his overall team to rush some of the supplies and fuel back to the base. Johansson felt abandoned, and when he made it back to camp 17 hours after Abinson, fighting through a blizzard, they had a heated exchange. As a result, Abinson revised his polar party to exclude Johansson, due to his violent insubordination. In Abinson's account of the expedition, he doesn't credit Johansson with contributing anything. Shortly after his return to Norway, Johansson returned to heavy drinking, and the next year he committed suicide. What does this incident tell us about Abinson? Well, at worst, we can accept Johansson's charge that he abandoned members of his party and put them in unnecessary danger. At best, we can see Abinson as ruthlessly practical, trying to preserve as many men and supplies as possible, risking some lives to save the overall expedition. Consider that this kind of ruthlessness would likely have saved Scott and his remaining crew members. But between Johansson and the dog slaughtering, Abinson seems to have put achieving goals ahead of protecting his team. Scott, on the other hand, acted according to the ideals of a British naval officer. He maintained strict hierarchies on his expeditions, even separating officers from enlisted men in their overwintering quarters, and insisting on keeping the crew on regimes of exercise. Despite this, he was also known to make impulsive decisions. Despite having done months of calculations regarding the supplies that he would need for his final polar push, he decided at the last minute to bring another man on, which further stretched his poor supply. It seems that all of Scott's officers took for granted the imperative to rescue men overstocking the supply depots. Scott, for his own part, refused to leave any member of his five-man polar party behind, which slowed their pace drastically when two of the men became sick and slowly died. And then there's his decision to collect and haul 30 pounds of fossils even after they had begun to flag. I respect it a lot, but it's not a decision that Amundsen or Shackleton would have made. Scott's character has been the subject of quite a bit of debate, with some historians calling him, quote, a great historic hero, and others, quote, one of the worst of the polar explorers. In the end, I think he embodied the English gentleman officer of his time. He stood on formality, he insisted on exercising his mind and body in equal measure, and in the end, he overestimated his abilities and the abilities of his crew. A member of Scott's team on the Terra Nova expedition, in his History of Antarctic Exploration, wrote, "For a joint scientific and geographical piece of organization, give me Scott. For a dash to the pole and nothing else, Amundsen. And if I am in a devil of a hole and I want to get out of it, give me Shackleton every time." Shackleton reminds me of, like, Teddy Roosevelt or Ernest Hemingway, as opposed to Scott and Amundsen, who were primarily funded by governments and geographical societies. Shackleton funded his expeditions mostly with private investors, which took considerably more PR work on his part. He was a member of the Merchant Navy, a commercial shipping system within the British Empire, and he was not a member of the British Navy proper. As such, he did not stand on the formality that Scott did. He made no distinction between how officers and crewmen lived. He had lost face with his apparent breakdown on the Discovery expedition, the incident that started his feud with Scott. On his Nimrod expedition, however, he failed to reach the South Pole, but was credited with shrewd and selfless decision-making, and got all of his men home safely. He apparently gave his own rations to his men when the situation became dire, which won him tremendous respect. But the best story of his heroism is from his transantarctic expedition of 1914. So let's return to that first image of polar exploration that I gave you. You're Shackleton, standing on the polar ice, 1,500 miles from help, and your ship has sunk. What do you do then? Well, if you're Shackleton, you shoot the carpenter's cat. This was a humane act, but the fact remains, you really did not want to be an animal on these expeditions. Shackleton ordered that the weakest animals be shot to spare them the slow death of starving or freezing on the ice. He attempted two marches to reach solid land faster, but the ice was too uneven to make any meaningful progress, so they camped out and waited for the drift to carry them to sea. During this time, the carpenter, Henry McNish, staged a brief mutiny. It's also at this point that they ate the dogs. Finally, the ice began to break up, and the crew sailed in lifeboats to the nearest land, a rocky, desolate, windswept island. It was called Elephant Island. By now, food was low, morale was low, and several members were in failing health. As a result, Shackleton's most precious resource was time. He had McNish modify one of the lifeboats to make it more seaworthy, cannibalizing the other lifeboats to reinforce the one. Shackleton selected a crew of five to join him on his desperate attempt to reach South Georgia Island, which he knew had a camp for whalers that operated during the summer. Winter was now setting in, but Shackleton still considered South Georgia to be their best hope. For his party, he selected a navigator, three of his strongest sailors, and McNish. Although McNish was relatively frail at this point, this was likely a canny move by Shackleton to separate the person with the lowest morale from the group that would need to camp out in awful conditions on the island for several more months. I think that Scott or Amundsen would have seen McNish as a greater liability on the rescue mission than to leave behind. But Shackleton understood that morale would be a deciding factor on whether the people left in the Polar Island camp would survive, and McNish posed a greater danger to their survival than to his. Shackleton took only enough provisions to reach the island, not allowing himself any room for error. They managed to make the open boat journey across the freezing expanse of ocean, facing waves of up to 60 feet tall and a 22-foot-long modified lifeboat. They managed to find South Georgia Island after 16 days and landed utterly exhausted. Unfortunately, they landed on the south side of the island, and the whaling camp was on the north side. Unwilling to risk another sea voyage, Shackleton and the two strongest men made the 36-hour march across the mountainous and unmapped icy island, and finally reached the harbor. In the 2 years since the expedition left, the camp on South Georgia Island had become staffed year-round. They had finally found help. Shackleton quickly rescued the rest of his crew on South Georgia, but saving the rest of his crew took some time. The British Admiralty had no ship nearby to spare. The year was now 1916, and the British Navy was working on other things. So, he cobbled together volunteer crews and asked South American governments to lend him ships. On his third attempt, he finally found an ice-free passage back to Antarctica and rescued the encamped crew. This is considered Shackleton's greatest feat, and not a single man died of the crew of the Endurance. If you recall, there was another crew laying supplies on the other side of the continent. The Aurora also faced great difficulties, and sadly, three of the men on that half of the expedition perished before Shackleton could mount their rescue, which he did immediately after rescuing the Endurance crew. The five men of Scott's polar party were not so lucky. They froze to death 11 miles south of their resupply depot while trying to wait out a blizzard for 10 days. Scott wrote a message to the public that ended with, quote, "Had we lived, I should have a tale to tell of the hardiness, endurance, and courage of all my companions, which would have stirred the heart of every Englishman. These rough notes and our dead bodies must tell the tale, but surely, surely, a great rich country like ours will see that those who are dependent on us are properly provided for." In November of that year, 1912, members of the expedition found Scott's tent and gave the three remaining men within a burial under the snow. So, considering all the factors that I've mentioned, vessel, logistics, motivation, and character, why was Scott's expedition fatal when Shackleton's and Amundsen's were not? The question is difficult to answer, in part because Scott died just 11 miles away from that supply depot, and if he had made it there, there's a good chance he could have survived. As historical forensic investigators, there's lots of ways for us to find Scott's 11 miles. As we move from broad to more specific concerns, a ton of what-ifs pop up. So there's motivation. Even though Scott had suffered setbacks that had increased his danger, he pressed on. And maybe the reason why he pressed on was this hope of beating both Shackleton and Amundsen. There's decision-making. Scott decided to put a major supply depot north of where it should have been, and decided to bring five men on his polar push instead of four, both of which undermined his earlier decisions. And then there's the weather. The summer of 1911-12 is confirmed by ice cores to be one of the coldest Antarctic summers in recent history. Scott died after being trapped in his tent for 10 straight days because of a blizzard. Had it cleared up sooner, he might have survived. And then we get down to the really practical things. Scott's expedition wasn't as familiar with dogs and skiing as Amundsen's was. He relegated dogs to support duties, which made his trek take longer. He didn't eat dogs or feed them to each other, which could have alleviated some of his issues. And then we find a whole array of accidents. One of the five men on their final trek, Evans, injured his hand, which made him less useful and slowed the party down, and then eventually contributed to his death. There were several accidents and injuries sustained by the support parties that were meant to resupply the depots, so those depots were not properly resupplied as planned. And then there's the dog team that went to rescue Scott but turned away early because of the lack of dog food. He easily could have bridged those last few miles. So I think we need to add one more factor to our list here. There's climate, motivation, skill, logistics, decision-making, and there's luck. Scott didn't die because something went wrong. He died because so many things went wrong exactly the right way. He died because things didn't go right. He did have redundancy, he had planning, he had support, he had really well thought through this whole thing, but mishaps eventually overcame the expedition's resiliency. Had any one or two of those things gone right, he could have survived. So this has been my look into surviving the South Pole. I hope I've given you some insight into the ideas surrounding exploration, in addition to the South Pole conquest in specific. And next time you think about exploring, let's spare a thought for the ponies, spare a thought for Mrs. Chippy the cat, and all those dogs. I think this can be generalized a little bit outward as well to, you know, all the dogs and animals that were shot into space and never brought back. They made real sacrifices, and we should honor them. I'm Peter McGuire, and this has been my Unlikely Explanation.